waited for darkness. The hordes of the Northland army began to cross in force as twilight fell. In mingled astonishment and fear, the men of the Border Legion watched as the hundreds that had first crossed turned to thousands, and still they kept coming. It was a frightening spectacle the bordermen beheld, an army of such incredible size that it completely covered the land on both sides of the Myrmidon as far as the eye could see. But its size hampered its maneuverability, and the chain of command seemed disorganized and confused. There was no concentrated effort made to dislodge the entrenched Tyrzians from the small rise. Instead, the bulk of the army milled about on the banks of the southern shore after crossing, as if waiting for someone to tell them what to do next. Several squads of heavily armed trolls made a series of rushes at the Legion command, but they were equally matched in numbers, and the veteran soldiers quickly repelled them. When darkness came at last, the enemy army suddenly began to organize into columns five deep, and Balinor knew that the first sustained rush would break the Legion to pieces. With the skill and daring that had made him the spirit behind the fabled Border Legion and the finest field commander in the Southland, the Prince of Calahorn began to execute a most difficult tactical maneuver. Without waiting for the enemy to strike, he suddenly divided his army and attacked far to the right and left of the Northland columns. Striking sharply in short feints and taking full advantage of the darkness in terrain every borderman knew well, the soldiers of the Legion drew in the flanks of the enemy to form a ragged half-circle. Each time the circle grew tighter, and each time the Tyrzians retreated a little farther. Balinor and Fandwick held the left flank while Actun and Messaline commanded the right. The enraged enemy began to charge madly, stumbling awkwardly over the unfamiliar ground in the growing darkness, the retreating soldiers of the Legion always just a few steps out of reach. Slowly Balinor drew his flanks in and narrowed his lines, pulling the searching Northlanders in with him. Then, when the foot soldiers had completely fallen back in retreat, covered by the darkness and the battle behind them, the skilled cavalry drew their lines together in a final feint and slipped from between the jaws of the closing enemy trap and was gone. Suddenly the right and left flanks of the harried Northland army met, each believing that the other was the hated enemy that had eluded it for several hours. Without hesitating, they attacked. How many trolls and gnomes were slain by their own people would never be known, but the fighting was still raging when Balinor and the two divisions of the Border Legion arrived safely at the gates of Tirsis. The horses' hooves and soldiers' feet had been muffled to cover their retreat. With the exception of a squad of horsemen who had strayed too far west and been cut off and decimated, the Legion had escaped intact. Yet the damage done to the mammoth Northland army had not stopped its advance, and the Myrmidon, the first line of defense to the city of Tirsis, had been lost. Now the vast encampment of the enemy sprawled on the grasslands below the city, the night fires burning as far as the eye could see through the moonlit darkness. At dawn, the assault on Tirsis would begin as the combined strength of thousands of trolls and gnomes, obedient to the will of the warlock lord, hurled itself against the towering band of stone and iron that formed the outer wall. One would eventually shatter. Hendel, sitting thoughtfully across from Balinor at the small dining table, recalled again the ominous sensation he had felt earlier that day while inspecting with Janna Senpre the fortifications of the great city. Unquestionably, the outer wall was a formidable barrier, but there was something wrong. He had been unable to put his finger on exactly what was causing his uneasiness, but even now, in the solitude of the dining room and the warm companionship of his friends, he could not shake the nagging suspicion that something vital had been overlooked in preparing for the long siege that lay ahead. Mentally, he retraced the lines of defense protecting the sprawling city. At the edge of the bluff, the men of Tircis had erected a low bulwark to prevent the enemy from gaining a foothold on the plateau. If the Northlanders could not be contained on the grasslands below the bluff, then the border legion would fall back into the city proper and rely on the mammoth outer wall to halt the enemy advance. The rear approach to Tircis was cut off by the sheer cliffs that rose hundreds of feet into the air directly behind the palace grounds. Balinor had assured him that the cliffs could not be scaled. They were like smooth sheets of rock, completely without the normal nooks and crannies that would permit a foothold. The defenses surrounding Tircis should be impenetrable. And yet, Hendel remained dissatisfied. For a moment his thoughts drifted back to his homeland, to Cullhaven and to his family, whom he hadn't seen in weeks. He had never spent much time with them, his whole life expended in the ceaseless border wars in the Anar. He missed the woodlands and the green shading that came with the spring and summer months, and he suddenly wondered how he had let so much time pass without a visit home. Perhaps he would never get back. The thought swept through his mind and vanished. He had no time for regrets. Durin and Dale conversed soberly with Balinor, their own thoughts centered on the Westland. Dale, like Hendel, was thinking of his home. He was frightened of the battle that lay ahead, but he accepted his fear, encouraged by the presence of the others and determined that he would do no less than they in standing firm against the army that had come to destroy them. He thought quietly of Linlis, her shy, warm face a permanent fixture in his mind. He would be fighting for her safety as well as his own. Durin studied his brother, noting the sudden smile, and he knew without asking that the youth was thinking of the elven girl he was to marry. Nothing was more important to Durin than the safety of Dale. From the beginning he had made a point of staying close to his brother to protect him. Several times during the long journey to Paranor, they had nearly lost their lives. Tomorrow would bring still greater danger, and once again, Durin would be watching over his brother. Briefly he thought of Eventine and the mighty elven armies, wondering if they would reach Tircis in time. Without their great strength to supplement the border legion, the hordes of the warlock lord would eventually break through the city's defenses. He picked up his wine glass and drank deeply, the liquid warm in his throat. His sharp eyes surveyed the faces of the others and came to rest momentarily on the troubled face of Menyon Lee. Lean Highlander had devoured his dinner ravenously, having eaten nothing for almost 24 hours. Finishing long before his companions, he had contented himself with a fresh glass of wine, directing continual questions to Balinor about the afternoon's battle. Now, in the quiet hours of early morning, with dinner completed and the wine seeping through him like a slow drowsiness, it suddenly occurred to him that the key to everything that had happened since Cullhaven, and everything that would happen in the days remaining, was Alanon. He could not bring himself to think any more of Shae and the sword, nor even of Shurl. He could only see in the forefront of his mind the dark, forbidding figure of the mysterious druid. Alanon held the answers to every question. He alone knew the secret of the talisman men called the Sword of Shannara. He alone knew the purpose behind the strange appearance of the shrouded wraith in the Valley of Shale. The druid Bremen, a man over 500 years dead. He alone, in every instance, along every step of the dangerous journey to Paranor, had known what to expect and how to deal with it. Yet the man himself had remained an enigma. Now he was gone from them, and only Flick, if he were still alive, could ask him what was going to happen to them. They all depended on Alanon for survival, but what would the giant druid do? What was left to him when the Sword of Shannara was lost? What was left when the young heir of Gerald Shannara was missing and probably dead? Menyon bit his lip in anger as the hated thought slipped quickly through his mind and was banished. Shay had to be alive. Menyon cursed everything that had brought them all to this sorry end. They had allowed themselves to be backed into a corner. There was only one path still open to them. In the holocaust of tomorrow's battle, human beings would die, and few, if any, would know the reason. It was an unavoidable part of war, that men should die for unknown reasons. It had been happening for centuries. But this war was something beyond human comprehension, this war between a substanceless spirit being and mortals. How could evil such as the Warlock Lord be destroyed when it could not even be understood? Only Alanon seemed fully to appreciate the nature of the creature. But where was the druid when they needed him most? The candles burned low on the table before them, and the darkness of the secluded room deepened. On the wood and tapestry-decorated walls, torches sputtered slowly in their iron racks, and the five voices dropped to low murmurs, hushed as if the night were a child in danger of being unexpectedly awakened. The city of Tirsis slept now, and in the grasslands beyond, the Northland army. In the peace and solitude of the moonlit night, it seemed that all forms of life were at rest, and that war, with its promise of death and pain, was merely a vague, nearly forgotten memory of years past. But the five who spoke in quiet tones of better days and the friendship shared could not, even for a few moments, completely stifle the lingering realization that the horror of war was no more distant than the sunrise, and as inevitable as the darkness of the Warlock Lord, reaching slowly, inexorably from out of the north to snuff out their frail lives. Chapter 30. On the morning of the third day of the search for Oral Fane, the torrential rains that had swept through the vastness of the barren Northland subsided, and the sun reappeared as a dim, fuzzy ball of white fire, burning through the misty darkness left with the passing of the Warlock Lord's black wall to the mud and rock-strewn terrain with the fury of an oven. The storm had left the topography of the land completely altered, the rains sweeping away almost every distinguishable landmark and leaving only four identical horizons of rocky hillocks and muddied valleys. At first, the appearance of the sun was a welcome sight. The heat from its rays penetrated the hateful gloom that had become permanently affixed to the barren surface of the earth to warm away the chill left by the now vanished storm as the temperature rose steadily and the character of the land began to alter once more. But in an hour's time the temperature had risen 30 degrees and was continuing to rise unchecked. The rivers that washed through the winding gullies carved out by the force of the rain began to steam and mist in the heat, and the humidity soared, drenching everything in a new, even more uncomfortable wetness. The little plant life born in the aftermath of the devastating storm withered and died in suffocation, cut off from the sun's life-giving brightness and choked by the stifling heat that permeated the graying mist. The muddied earth lay unprotected from the heat and soon baked into a cracked, hardened clay that would support no life. The rivers and lakes and puddles began to dry up quickly, and in almost no time had disappeared altogether. The exposed surface of the huge boulders that dotted the parched land quickly absorbed the burning heat like iron settled in live coals. Slowly, inexorably, the land became what it had been before the rains had swept its surface. A dry, barren slab of earth, devoid of life, silent and forbidding beneath a vast, cloudless sky. The only movement came from the slow, unchanging arc of an ageless, disinterested sun as it followed its ceaseless path from east to west, turning days into years and years into centuries. Three bent figures stepped gingerly from beneath the shelter of a rocky alcove, cut in the side of one of the countless nondescript hillocks, their cramped bodies straightening slowly, their eyes peering grimly into the unbroken wall of mist. They stood for long moments in the lifeless gloom, staring into the dying land that seemed to stretch on forever, a dismal graveyard of rocky mounds that covered the mortal remains of those who had ventured into this forbidden kingdom. There was absolute silence filtering evilly through the misty grayness, hanging its unspoken warning of death in the minds of the three living creatures. They stood in apprehensive watchfulness, staring at the wasteland surrounding them. Shay turned to his companions. Panamon Creel was arching his back and rubbing his limbs in an effort to awaken the benumbed muscles. His dark hair was shaggy and unkempt, his broad face shaded by a 3-day beard. He had a haggard look about him, but the keen eyes burned warily as he met Shay's inquisitive stare. The massive Keltset had moved noiselessly to the summit of the hill and was surveying the northern horizon. They had huddled in the sparse shelter of their rocky alcove for almost 3 days while the fierce Northland storm had raged unchecked through the empty lands about them. 3 days lost in the pursuit of Orlfane and the Sword of Shannara. 3 days during which all traces of the elusive gnome had been thoroughly obliterated. They had crouched restlessly amid the boulders, eating because it was necessary, sleeping because there was nothing else to do. Talking had given Shay and Panamon a greater understanding of one another, though Keltset still remained a complete enigma. Shay persisted in his belief that they should have ignored the storm and pursued their quarry, but Panamon had refused to discuss the idea. No one could travel far in such a storm, and Orlfane would be forced to seek shelter or risk being caught in a mudslide or drowned in the swift gully rivers. In any event, the thief had calmly reasoned, the gnome would have made little progress. Keltset descended from the crest of the hill, making a quick sweeping gesture with one hand. The horizon was clear. There was no further discussion of what should be done. It was already decided. Picking up their meager possessions, they trudged briskly down the side of the steep embankment, angling northward. For once, Shay and Panamon were in complete agreement. The search for the Sword of Shannara had become more than a matter of injured pride, more than a mission to seek out a mysterious talisman. It had become a dangerous, frantic hunt for the one means, however questionable, by which they might stay alive in this savage land. The fortress of the Warlock Lord lay amid the tall, black peaks directly north. Behind them lay the deadly wall of mist that marked the outer boundaries of the Skull Kingdom. To escape this hated land, they would have to pass one way or the other. The obvious choice was to go back through the misty darkness, but while the Elfstones might show them a passage to the Southland, using them would also reveal their presence to the spirit world. Alanon had told Shay so at Cullhaven, and he in turn had told Panamon. The Sword of Shannara was the one weapon that could protect them from the Warlock Lord, and if they had it in their possession, they could be assured of at least a fighting chance. The basic plan was to regain possession of the talisman and escape back through the Wall of Darkness as quickly as possible. It was hardly a brilliant strategy, but under the circumstances it would have to do. Traveling was as difficult as it had been prior to the storm. The ground was hard and coated with rubble and loose topsoil that made the footing treacherous. Scrambling and clawing their way over the rough terrain, the three were quickly covered with dirt and bruised by continual falls. Because of the unevenness of the topography, it was difficult to keep their bearings and nearly impossible to calculate their progress. Landmarks were non-existent, and the country looked almost exactly the same in every direction. The minutes wore away with agonizing slowness, and still they discovered nothing. The humidity continued to rise, and the garments worn by the three men were quickly soaked through with sweat. They removed their cloaks and tied them on their backs. It would be cold again when the night descended. "This is the place we last saw him." Panamon stood motionlessly at the summit of the broad hill they had just scaled, breathing heavily. Shay reached his side and glanced about in disbelief. All the surrounding hills looked exactly the same as this one, save for small variations in size and shape. He stared dubiously at the horizon. He wasn't even sure where they had come from.
"Keltset, what do you see?" the other man demanded.
The rock troll strode slowly about the hilltop, scanning the ground for any trace left by the passage of the little gnome, but the storm appeared to have erased any signs. He moved about noiselessly for several minutes more, then turned to them and shook his head negatively. Panamon's dirt-stained face burned red in sudden anger.
"He was here. We walk on a bit farther."
They moved ahead in silence, scrambling unceremoniously down one hill and up the next. There was no further discussion. There was nothing further to be said. If Panamon were mistaken, nobody had any better idea except to keep looking. An hour crawled by as they labored northward. Still, there was nothing. Shay began to realize the hopelessness of their task. It would be impossible to search all of the land stretching east and west. If the wily gnome had traveled just 50 yards to either side of them, they would probably never know he had gone that way. Perhaps he had been buried in a mudslide during the storm along with the sword, and they would never find him. Shay's muscles ached from the strenuous climbing, and he considered calling a brief halt to reassess their decision to proceed in this direction. Perhaps they should try to cut across the elusive trail. Yet a glance at Panamon's dark face quickly dissuaded the veilman from even suggesting such an action. The tall adventurer had the same look in his face Shay had seen just before he had destroyed the gnomes days ago. He was the hunter once more. If Panamon found him, Oral Fane was a dead man. Shay shuddered involuntarily and looked away. Several hills later, they found a piece of what they were searching for. Keltset spotted it from atop a small hillock, his sharp eyes picking out the foreign object as it lay half buried in dust at the bottom of a small ravine. Directing the other two, he slid quickly down the rock-strewn hill and rushed eagerly over to the discarded object, snatching it up and holding it out to them. It was a large strip of cloth, cloth that had once been the major portion of a tunic sleeve. They stared at it quietly for a moment, and then Shay looked at Keltset for confirmation that it was indeed Oral Fane's. The giant troll nodded solemnly. Panamon Creel impaled the piece of cloth on the end of his pike, smiling grimly. "So we've found him again. This time he won't get away." But they didn't find him that day, nor did they discover any further signs of his passing. In the heavy dust, the gnome's footprints would have clearly shown, yet there were none. Despite Panamon's earlier opinion, Oral Fane had somehow wandered on during the storm, escaping both mudslides and drowning. The rain had washed away his tracks, but with freakish perversity had left uncovered the torn sleeve. It could have been washed down from anywhere, so there was no way to tell which direction the gnome had come from or gone. By nightfall, the blackness shrouding the land was so heavy that it was impossible to see more than several feet, and the search was reluctantly abandoned for the night. With Keltzett standing the first watch, Panamon and Shay collapsed in near exhaustion and fell asleep almost instantly. The night air was cool, though the humidity of the day lingered on, and all three wrapped themselves once again in the half-dry hunting cloaks. The morning returned all too swiftly in the familiar graying haze. This day was not as humid as the previous one, but it was no more cheerful. The sun was still nearly blotted out by the leaden mist that hung immovably overhead. The same eerie silence persisted, and the three men stared about with a feeling of complete isolation from the living world. The vast emptiness was beginning to have a noticeable effect on both Shay and Panamon Creel. Shay had grown edgy and nervous in these past several days, and the normally cheerful and talkative Panamon had lapsed into almost total silence. Keltzett alone retained his usual demeanor, his face as bland and implacable as ever. A short breakfast was consumed without interest, and the search began again. They resumed the hunt almost with distaste. Their common desire was to end this wearing trek quickly. They went ahead partly out of a sense of self-preservation, and partly because they had nowhere else to go. Although neither realized it, both Panamon and Shay were beginning to wonder why Keltzett continued the pursuit. He was in his own country and could probably have survived alone had he chosen to go his own way. The two men had tried unsuccessfully to decipher Keltzett's reasons for continuing on with them during the three-day rain, and now, too worn to reason the matter further, they had fallen back on suspicious acceptance of his presence and a growing determination that they would know who and what he was before this journey ended. They plodded on through the dust and the haze as the morning drifted dully into noonday. It was totally unexpected when Panamon suddenly drew up short. Tracks! The tall thief let out a wild yell of delight and charged madly into the small draw to their left, leaving both Keltzett and Shay staring after him in amazement. Moments later, the trio knelt eagerly over a set of clearly defined footprints outlined in the heavy dust. There was no mistaking their origin. Even Shay recognized that they were made by gnome boots, worn and cracked about the heels. The trail they left was undisguised, leading generally northward, but weaving badly, as if the destination of the man passing were no longer certain. It almost appeared as if Orlfane were wandering aimlessly. They paused a moment longer and then rose hurriedly at Panamon's urgent command. The tracks were only hours old, and judging from their meandering nature, the elusive Orlfane could be overtaken easily. Panamon could only thinly disguise the almost vicious glee that surged through his revitalized body as he saw the end of the long hunt in sight. Without speaking further, the three hitched up their cumbersome gear and moved northward in grim resolution. This was the day they would catch Orlfane. The trail left by the little gnome wound in erratically confusing fashion through the dusty hills of the lower Northland. At times, the three found themselves traveling almost directly eastward, and once they were turned about entirely. The afternoon wore on with tedious precision, and while Keltzett indicated that the footprints were growing fresher, it appeared that they were still not gaining rapidly. If nightfall set in before they had caught up with their quarry, they might very well lose him once again. Twice before they had been on the verge of catching him, and each time an unexpected occurrence had forced them temporarily to abandon the search. They were not in the mood to have this happen a third time, and Shay had inwardly vowed that if need be, he would track Orlfane even in total darkness. The giant peaks of the forbidding skull kingdom loomed menacingly in the distance, their black razor tips jutting knife-like into the horizon. There was a sense of fear in the mind of the Veilman that he could not shake, a fear that had grown steadily stronger as the three men had pushed deeper into the Northland. He had begun to feel that he was undertaking much more than he had originally imagined, that somehow the search for Oral Fane and the Sword of Shannara was only a small part of a much larger scheme of events. He was not yet panicked by what he felt, but he was prodded by an urgent need to finish this insane chase and turn back to his own land. It was mid-afternoon when the hilly terrain began to level off into a rolling plainland that enabled the three men to see for greater distances and to walk upright in an almost relaxed manner for the first time since they had passed through the Black Wall. The country ahead spread out before them with breathtaking starkness, a bleak, empty plain of brown earth and gray rock that rolled unevenly northward toward the tall peaks that bordered the Skull Kingdom and the home of the Warlock Lord. These vast flatlands diminished the farther north the eye traveled, breaking around the masses of rock and mountainous ridgeland that led in stepping stone manner to the awesome peaks beyond. The entire expanse, naked, hot, and desolate, lay masked in the same eerie, deathly silence. Nothing moved. No creature stirred. No insect hummed. No bird flew. Not even the wind brushed against the layered dust. Everywhere there was the same blasted emptiness, unmarked by life, shrouded with death. The winding tracks of Oral Fane led into this vastness and disappeared far in the distance. It was as if the land had swallowed him up. The hunters paused for several long minutes, their faces mirroring their obvious reluctance to proceed into this unfriendly land. But there was little time for weighing the merits of the matter, and they moved ahead. The twisting path was visible for a greater distance in this rolling plainland, and the three pursuers were able to track on a more direct course. They began to make up time quickly. Less than 2 hours later, Keltset indicated that they were no more than an hour behind their quarry. Dusk was rapidly approaching, the sun dipping behind a broken horizon far to the west. The dim twilight was masked further still by the ever-present gray haze, and the terrain was beginning to take on a peculiarly fuzzy appearance. The trio had followed the gnome's trail into a deep draw that was formed by a series of high ridges cropped by sharp overhangs and great, jutting rock formations. The fading sunlight was lost almost entirely in the shadows of the darkened valley, and Panamon Creel, who had eagerly taken the lead some time earlier, was forced to squint sharply to find the outline of the footprints in the heavy dust. They slowed to a halting walk as the thief bent closer to the earth. So intent was Panamon Creel on studying the tracks immediately before him that it came as a shock when the prints abruptly ended. Shay and Keltset were at his side instantly, and it was only after a careful study of the ground ahead of them that they were able to discover that someone had methodically brushed away all further traces of the little gnome's passing. It was in that same instant that the huge, dark forms began to detach themselves from the shadows of the draw, lumbering ponderously forward in the deepening twilight. Shay saw them first, but believed his eyes were playing tricks on him. Panamon was quicker to realize what was happening. Springing upright, the thief drew out the great broadsword and raised his pike. He might have made a rush to break through the tightening ring, but the normally predictable Keltset did a surprising thing. Springing quickly forward, he pulled the astonished thief back. Panamon stared incredulously at his silent companion, then reluctantly lowered his weapons. There were at least a dozen forms standing guardedly all around the three men, and even in the hazy twilight, a terrified Shay realized that they had been discovered by a band of giant trolls. The company of weary elven riders reined in their sweating mounts and gazed absently down the valley slopes into the broad length of the Wren. 2 miles of empty valley stretched eastward before them, the high slopes to either side cresting in sharp ridges lined with thinning stretches of trees and scrub brush. The legendary pass had served for over 1,000 years as the gateway from the lower Strelaheim plains to the great forests of the Westland, a natural door to the homeland of the elves. It was in this famous pass that the awesome might of the armies of the warlock lord had been broken in defeat by the elven legions and Jarl Shannara. It was here that Brona had faced and run from the aged Bremen and the mysterious power of the Sword of Shannara, run with his great armies back into the plainlands, only to be halted by advancing dwarf armies, trapped and destroyed. The Pass of Wren had seen the beginning of the downfall of the greatest threat the world had encountered since the devastating Great Wars, and the people of all the races looked upon this peaceful valley as a historic landmark. It was a natural monument of mankind's history that some had journeyed halfway around the world to see, just so that they too might feel somehow a part of that terrible event. John Lynn Sander gave the order to dismount, and the elven riders climbed down gratefully. His concern was not with the history of the past, but with the immediate future. Worriedly, he stared at the heavy black wall descending from the Northland across the plains of Strelaheim, its hazy shadow drawing daily nearer to the borders of the Westland and the home of the elves. His sharp eyes peered far into the eastern horizon where the darkness had already permeated into the forests surrounding the ancient fortress of Perenor. He shook his head bitterly and cursed the day he had permitted himself to leave the side of his king and oldest friend. He had grown to manhood with Eventine, and when his friend became king, he had stayed with him as his personal counselor and self-appointed watchdog. Together they had prepared for the invasion of the armies of Brona, the spirit lord they had once believed destroyed in the Second War of the Races. The mysterious wanderer Alanon had warned the elven people, and while some had scoffed in misconceived disdain, Eventine had known better. Alanon had never been wrong. His ability to see into the future was uncanny, but unerringly accurate. The elven people had followed Eventine's advice, and they had prepared for war, but the invasion did not come as expected. Then Perenor had fallen, and with it the Sword of Shannara. Again Alanon had come to them, asking that they patrol the plains of Strelaheim above Perenor to guard against any attempt by the gnomes holding the druid fortress to move the sword northward to the castle of the warlock lord. Again they had obeyed without question. But the unexpected had happened, and it had happened while John Lynn Sander was away from the king. The gnomes entrenched at Perenor had unexpectedly decided to break for the safety of the deep Northland, and 3 heavy patrols made a rush at the elven lines. Eventine and John Lynn had led separate commands to intercept 2 of these forces and would have destroyed the gnomes easily had it not been for the planned intervention of a combined army of gnomes and trolls detached from the now advancing Northland army of the warlock lord. John Lynn's command was nearly annihilated, and he barely escaped with his life. He had been unable to reach Eventine, and the elven king had disappeared with his entire patrol. John Lynn Sander had been searching for him for nearly 3 days. "We will find him, John Lynn. He is not an easy one to kill. He will find a way to survive." The grim elf nodded with a barely perceptible shake of his close-cropped head, his darting eyes glancing quickly at the young face of the man standing next to him. "It's a strange thing, but I know he's alive," the other continued soberly. I can't really explain how I know. It's just something I can sense. Breen Elicidil was Eventine's younger brother. He was also the next king of the Westland Elves if his brother were dead. It was a position he was not yet ready for and quite honestly did not want. Since Eventine's disappearance, he had done nothing to assume command of the languishing elven armies or of the dismayed king's council, but had joined immediately in the search for his brother. As a result, the elven government was in a state of near chaos, and what had only 2 weeks earlier been a people united against the imminent threat of invasion from the north was now an unsure, divided cluster of separated groups, badly frightened because there was no one prepared to assume leadership of the government. The elven people would not panic altogether. They were far too disciplined to allow matters to fall apart totally. But Eventine had been an undeniably powerful personality, and the people had been united solidly behind him since his ascension to the throne. Young, but possessing unusual strength of character and an infallible common sense, he had always been there to advise them, and they had always listened. The rumors of his disappearance had shaken the people badly. But neither Breen Elicidil nor John Lynn had time to worry about anything but finding the missing king. After skirting gnome patrols and the main body of the Northland army while they searched, the haggard survivors of the decimated elven patrols had returned briefly to the tiny outland village of Koos, where they had obtained fresh horses and supplies. Now they were on their way back to pick up the search once more. John Lynn Sander believed he knew where Eventine would be found if he were still alive. The giant Northland army had moved south toward the kingdom of Callahorn almost a week earlier, and it would pass no farther until the famed Border Legion had been destroyed. It was probable that if Eventine were a prisoner, as both Breen and he now believed must be the case, they would find him with the commanders of Brona's invasion force as a hostage of great bargaining value. With Eventine Elicidil defeated, cities whose leaders were lesser men would be more willing to consider surrender. In any event, the warlock lord recognized the importance of Eventine to the elven people. He was the most revered and beloved leader the elves had known since Jarl Shannara, and they would do almost anything to have him back safely. Dead, he would serve no purpose to the Spirit King, and his execution might so enrage the elves that they would reunite in their common desire to destroy him. But alive, Eventine was of immeasurable worth, for the elven people would not risk injury to their favorite son. John Lynn Sander and Breen Elicidil harbored no false illusions that Eventine would be safely returned to them, even if the army did not intervene in the Southland invasion. They were acting on their own initiative, gambling that they could find their friend and brother before his usefulness was ended, before the Southland fell. "That's enough. Mount up!" John Lynn's impatient voice cut through the momentary stillness with biting sharpness, and the lounging riders leaped to their feet hurriedly in response. He stared a final time at the distant blackness, then turned and vaulted easily onto his waiting mount, gathering the reins in one swift motion. Breen was already at his side, and seconds later the small body of horsemen was moving down the valley corridor at a fast trot. It was a gray morning, the air tinged with the pungent smell of last night's rain, still lingering on the plainlands. The tall grass was wet and yielding beneath the sharp hooves of the passing horses, muffling their impact. Far to the south, a trace of deep blue sky could be seen beyond the clouds. It was a cool day, and the elves rode comfortably in the moderate temperatures. They reached the end of the valley quickly, pulling their eager mounts to a slow trot as they entered the eastern corridor of the pass. The riders talked among themselves, though in low tones, for the borders of the Northland lay just beyond the pass gateway. The line of horsemen wound snake-like through the high ridges framing the eastern entryway, and moments later emerged onto the vast expanse of the plains of Strelaheim. John Lynn glanced almost casually across the emptiness that stretched out before him, and then abruptly reined in his horse. Bryn, a horseman. Instantly the other was at his side, and together they peered at the distant rider moving rapidly toward them. The elves stared curiously, unable to make out the features of the advancing horseman in the hazy light. For one brief instant, Bryn Elicidil was convinced it was his brother returning, but a moment later his hopes faded as he realized the man was too small to be Eventine. He was certainly no horseman. As he came up to them, he was hanging on to both the reins and the saddle horn for dear life, his broad face flushed and sweating from the effort. He was no elf. He was a Southlander. He brought his mount to a jolting halt in front of the elven band, pausing to catch his breath before speaking. He studied the amused faces confronting him, and his face turned a shade redder. "I met a man a few days earlier," the stranger began. Then he hesitated to be certain he had their attention. "He asked me to seek out the right arm of the elven king." The looks of amusement faded instantly as the elven riders leaned forward. "I am John Lynn Sander," the patrol commander acknowledged quietly. The exhausted rider sighed gratefully and nodded. "I'm Flick Omsford, and I've come all the way from Callahorn to find you." With no little effort, he dismounted and rubbed his aching backside. "If you'll give me a few minutes' rest, I'll take you to Eventine." Shay marched in silence between two of his giant troll captors, unable to shake the feeling that Kel'Thuzet had betrayed them. The ambush had been cleverly sprung, but they might at least have attempted to fight their way clear. Instead, on Kel'Thuzet's unexpected command, they had offered no resistance, allowing themselves to be willingly disarmed. Shay had hoped that Kel'Thuzet might know one of the trolls in the raiding party, or that being of the same race, he could reason with them and secure their release. But the giant troll had not even tried to communicate with his captors, docilely permitting them to bind his hands without the slightest struggle. Panamon Creel and Shay had their weapons removed and their hands tied, and the three captives were marched northward into the barren flatlands. The little Veilmen still had possession of the elf stones, but they were useless against the trolls. He studied the broad back of Panamon, who was walking directly in front of him, wondering what the irascible thief's thoughts must be. The man had been so astonished at his companion's quick surrender that he had not spoken one word since. Obviously, he could not bring himself to believe that he had so misjudged the silent giant whose life he had saved and whose friendship he had valued. The troll's behavior was a complete mystery to them both. But whereas Shay was merely confused, Panamon Creel was deeply hurt. Whatever else there was between them, Kel'Thuzet had been his friend. The one friend he felt he could depend on. The hardened adventurer's disbelief would quickly turn to hatred, and Shay had always known that whatever the circumstances, Panamon Creel was a dangerous man to make an enemy. It was impossible to determine where they were being taken. The Northland night was a moonless black, and Shay was forced to turn his concentration to the task of finding his footing as the party wound its way northward through scattered boulders and high ridges strewn with loose earth and rock. The troll tongue was completely foreign to the Veilmen. Since Panamon had lapsed into brooding silence, Shay could learn nothing. If the trolls had reason to suspect who he was, then they would be taken to the warlock lord. The fact that they had not bothered with the elf stones might be an indication that his captors had seized them merely as intruders without realizing what had brought them to the Northland. The possibility offered little comfort. The trolls would find him out quickly enough. He wondered suddenly what had become of the fleeing Orlfane. His tracks had ended where they had been seized, so the gnome must also be a prisoner. But where had they taken him? And what had become of the Sword of Shannara? They marched for hours in the impenetrable darkness. Shay quickly lost all track of time and finally became so exhausted that he collapsed and was carried like a sack of grain over the broad shoulder of one of his captors for the remainder of the journey. He awoke briefly to the flickering light of low-burning wood fires as the party entered an unfamiliar encampment, then felt himself lowered to the earth and led through the opening of a large tent. Inside, his hands were checked to be certain the bonds were secure and his feet were bound. Moments later, he was left alone. Panamon and Keltset had been taken elsewhere. Briefly, he struggled with the leather thongs that held his hands and feet, but they would not loosen, and finally he gave it up. He could feel himself drifting into sleep, the weariness from the long march flooding through his aching body. He tried to fight it, forcing himself to conceive a plan of escape. The harder he tried, the more difficult it became to think of anything, and everything in his tired mind grew steadily more hazy. He was asleep in 5 minutes. It seemed only moments later that he was awakened by rough hands shaking him out of the deep slumber into which he had fallen. He rose dazedly as a heavy-set troll spoke something unintelligible to him and pointed to a plate of food before passing out of the tent into the sunlight beyond. Shay squinted in the darkness of the tent, absently noting the familiar grayness of the Northland morning that signaled the beginning of another day. Realizing with mild astonishment that the leather bonds had been removed, he briskly rubbed his wrists and ankles to restore the circulation, and then ate quickly the meal prepared for him. There appeared to be a great deal of excitement outside his tent, and the shouts and cries of trolls moving hurriedly about the encampment filled the morning air. The Veilman finished his meal and had just determined to risk a glance through the closed flaps of the tent entrance when they were abruptly whipped aside. A burly troll guard stepped inside and motioned for Shay to come with him. With one hand tightly clenching his tunic front, where he could feel the reassuring bulk of the elfstones, the Veilman reluctantly followed. An escort of trolls led the small Southlander through a large encampment consisting of various-sized tents and stone huts constructed on a wide bluff, surrounded by a series of low ridges. Glancing at the distant horizon, he could tell that they were high above the barren plainlands they had crossed the previous night. The camp appeared deserted, and the voices Shay had heard earlier had faded entirely. The fires of the night before had died into ashes, and the tents and huts were all empty. A sudden chill struck the frightened captive, and it occurred to him that he was probably being led to his own execution. There was no sign of either Panamon or Keltset. Alanon, Flick, Menyonly, and all the others were somewhere in the Southland, unaware of his predicament. He was alone, and he was going to die. He was so paralyzed with fear that he could not even attempt to flee. He moved woodenly between his captors as they wound their way through the silent camp. A low ridge, marking the boundary of the encampment, loomed directly ahead of them, and then they were past the huts and tents and standing in a broad open clearing. Shay stared in disbelief. Dozens of trolls were seated in a wide semicircle facing the ridge, their heads turned toward him momentarily as he entered the clearing. At the base of the ridge sat three trolls of varying sizes, and though Shay could not be certain, probably of varying ages as well, each holding a brightly colored staff with a black pennant. Panamon Creel had been seated within the wide circle to one side. He had a peculiarly pensive look that did not alter as he caught sight of Shay. The attention of everyone was focused on the massive form of Kel'Thuzet, standing motionless in the center of the expectant trolls, his arms folded as he faced the three staff-bearers. He did not turn as Shay was led into the circle and seated next to the thoughtful Panamon. There was a long moment of complete silence. It was the strangest spectacle Shay had ever witnessed. Then one of the three trolls seated at the apex of the circle rose ceremoniously and tapped his staff lightly to the earth. The assemblage rose as one, turned sharply to face eastward, and spoke in unison several short lines in their own tongue. Then quietly, they sat down again. Can you imagine? They were praying. They were the first words Panamon had spoken, and Shay started in surprise. He glanced quickly at the thief, but the big man was looking at Kel'Thuzet. Another of the three trolls presiding over the strange assembly rose and spoke briefly to the attentive audience, gesturing several times toward Panamon and Shay. The little veil turned expectantly to his companion. This is a trial, Shay, the thief declared in a strangely dispassionate tone. Not for you or me, however. We're to be taken to the Skull Mountain beyond the Knife Edge, the kingdom of the Warlock Lord, where we'll be held for whatever. I don't think they know who we are yet. It is the command of the Spirit Lord that all Outlanders be brought to him, and we're being treated no differently. There's hope still. But a trial, Shay began doubtfully. For Kel'Thuzet. He has demanded the right to be tried by his own people rather than be turned over to Brona. It's an ancient custom. The request cannot be refused. He was found with us when his people were at war with our race. Any troll found with a man is presumed a traitor. There are no exceptions. Shay glanced involuntarily at Kel'Thuzet. The massive troll was seated with rock-like solidity in the center of the waiting assemblage as the voice of the presiding troll continued to drone on. They had been mistaken, the Veilman thought gratefully. Kel'Thuzet had not betrayed them. He had not given them away after all. But why had he allowed them to be taken captive so easily when he knew his own life would be forfeit as well? What will they do to him if they decide he is a traitor? He asked impulsively. A slight smile appeared on the tall man's lips. I know what you must be thinking. There was a touch of irony in the mocking voice. He is risking everything on this trial. If they find him guilty, he will be immediately thrown over the nearest cliff. He paused meaningfully and for the first time looked directly at the Veilman. I don't understand it either. They lapsed into silence once more as the speaker finished his lengthy statement and sat down. After a moment, a single troll came to stand before the three presiding trolls, whom Shay now realized must be judges, and made a brief statement. He was followed by several others, each of whom spoke briefly, responding to questions put to them by the judges. Shay could understand nothing of what was taking place, but supposed that the trolls were members of the raiding party that had captured them the previous night. The examination seemed to drag on forever, and still Kel'Thuzet had not moved a muscle. Shay studied the impassive giant, unable to understand why he had chosen to allow matters to go this way. Both Shay and Panamon had known for some time that Kel'Thuzet was no ordinary outcast, driven from his home and his people because he was unable to speak. Nor was he simply the thief and adventurer that Panamon had tried to make him. There was intelligence in those strangely gentle eyes. There was an unspoken knowledge of the Sword of Shannara, the Warlock Lord, and even Shay that had never been revealed. There was a past hidden deep within the giant's heart. He was Alanon all over again, Shay thought suddenly. Somehow both held the key to the secret of the power of the sword of Shannara. It was a strange revelation, and the Veilman shook his head questioningly, doubtful of his own reasoning. But there was no more time to think. The witnesses had finished, and the three judges had now called upon the accused to rise and defend himself. There was an impossibly long, agonizing moment of unbroken silence as the judges, the assembled trolls, Panamon Creel, and Shay all waited expectantly for Kel'Thuzet to rise. Still, the giant rock troll sat motionless, as if caught in an unbreakable trance. Shay was seized with an almost uncontrollable urge to shout wildly, if only to break the unbearable silence, but the sound caught in his throat. The seconds crawled by. Then, without warning, Kel'Thuzet rose. He drew his massive frame erect, abruptly taking on the appearance of a creature who was somehow more than mortal. There was pride in his bearing as he faced the waiting tribunal, his eyes fixed on the three judges. Without shifting his gaze even slightly, he reached under the broad leather belt that bound his waist and drew forth a large black metal pendant and chain. For a moment, he held it in his hands before the eyes of the judges, who leaned forward in obvious surprise. Shay caught a quick glimpse of a cross centered in a circle, and then the giant raised the chain ceremoniously above his head and settled it slowly about his great neck.
"By the gods that gave us life, I don't believe it," Panamon gasped in startled disbelief.
The judges, too, rose in astonishment. As Kel'Thuzet turned slowly about the circle of wondering trolls, shouts of excitement broke from their mouths and they were on their feet instantly, gesturing wildly at the impassive giant in their midst. Shay stared with the rest of them, completely befuddled.
"Panamon, what's happening?" he cried finally.
The intense roar of the aroused assemblage nearly drowned out his words, and Panamon Creel was suddenly on his feet too, one broad hand clapping down on Shay's slim shoulder.
"I don't believe it," the thief repeated with unrestrained joy. "All these months I've never even suspected it. That's what he's been hiding from us all along, my young Veilman. That's why he allowed us to be taken without a fight. But there must be more still."
"Will you tell me what's happening?" Shay demanded heatedly.
"The pendant, Shay. The cross and circle," the other shouted wildly. "It's the Black Oryx, the highest award, the greatest honor the troll people can give to one of their own. If you see three given in your lifetime, it's unusual. To receive one, you must be the living image of everything that Troll Nation cherishes and strives to attain. You must be the closest thing to a god that a mortal being can approach. Somewhere in his past, Kel'Thuzet has earned this honor, and we never guessed."
"But what about the fact that he was found with us?"
The little Veilman got only part of the query out.
"Anyone who wears the Oryx would never betray his own people," Panamon cut in sharply. "The honor carries with it an unbreakable trust. The wearer would never breach the laws of his people. He's presumed incapable of even contemplating such a thing. They believe that violation of such a trust would mean an eternity of punishment too horrible to imagine. No troll would consider it."
Shay stared dazedly back at Kel'Thuzet as the shouting continued unchecked. The great troll was again facing his judges while the three vainly attempted to restore order to the unheeding assembly. It took several minutes more before the noise abated enough for anyone to be heard. The trolls reseated themselves, anxiously waiting for Keltset to speak. There was a brief pause as a troll interpreter appeared at the side of the silent defendant. Then Keltset began to communicate in sign language. His eyes on Keltset's massive hands, the interpreter translated the explanation to the judges in the troll language. There was a brief exchange with one of the judges, none of which Shay was able to understand, but fortunately Panamon had already begun his own translation, whispering quietly to his anxious friend. "I told them that he comes from Norbane, one of the larger troll cities in the far northern Charnel Mountains. His family name is Malikos. He belongs to a very old and honored family. But they were all killed, supposedly by dwarves who had attempted to loot their family home. That judge on the left was asking Keltset how he had escaped. They had thought him dead as well. Must have been a pretty grisly affair for even this distant village to hear about it. But then, wait till you hear this, Shay. Keltset says the emissaries of the Warlock Lord destroyed his family. The Skullbearers came to Norbane almost a year ago, seizing control of the government and ordering the troll armies to accept their command. They managed to convince most of the city that Brona had come back from the dead, that he had survived for thousands of years and could not be killed by mortal hands. The Malikos family was one of the ruling families in Norbane, and they refused to submit, demanding that the city stand firm against the Warlock Lord. Keltset's word carried a lot of weight because he wore the Black Oryx. The Warlock Lord had the entire Malikos family decimated except for Keltset, whom he brought to his fortress in the Knife Edge. The story of the dwarf looters was a deception to inflame the troll citizenry to join in the Southland invasion. But Keltset managed to escape before they got him to the prisons, wandering southward until I found him. The Warlock Lord had ordered that his voice be burned out to prevent his communication with any living being, but he learned sign language. He waited for his chance to return to the Northland. One of the judges suddenly interrupted, and Panamon paused momentarily. The judge asked why he returned now. "Our big friend says he learned of Brona's fear of the power of the Sword of Shannara and the legend that a son of the Elven House would appear to take up the sword." Panamon trailed off abruptly as the interpreter turned back to Keltset. For the first time, the giant troll faced toward Shay, the strangely gentle eyes fixed intently on the little Veilman. An involuntary chill shook Shay. Then his massive companion gestured briefly to the waiting judges. Panamon hesitated, then spoke softly. "He says they must go with him to the Skull Kingdom, and that once inside the fortress, you, Shay, will destroy the Warlock Lord." Chapter 31 Palance Buckhanna died at dawn. Death came quietly, almost unexpectedly, as the first faint golden rays of sunlight crept searchingly into the darkness of the eastern horizon. He died without regaining consciousness. When Balinor was told, he merely nodded his head in acknowledgement and turned away. His friends stayed with him momentarily until Hendel silently motioned for them all to leave. In the hallway beyond the death room, they gathered quietly and spoke in hushed voices. Balinor was the last of the Buckhannas. If he died in the coming battle, the family name would disappear from the earth. Only history would remember. In the same hour, the assault on Tirsis began. It too came quietly, born with the dying of the night. As the waiting soldiers of the entrenched border legion peered into the gray plains below the great city walls, the light from the slowly rising sun revealed the mammoth Northland army spread out all the way to the distant Myrmidon, the carefully drawn formations giving a checkerboard appearance to the deep green of the grasslands. One moment the vast army stood silent, motionless on the plains below the city, shadows etched out of the darkness by dawn into figures of flesh and blood, iron and stone, and in the next they began to advance on the Tirzian defenders. The silence broke sharply with the sudden booming of gnome war drums, the deep, throbbing beat ringing ominously against the stone walls of Tirsis. The Northlanders came slowly, steadily, to the battle, the crashing of the drums matched by the thudding of booted feet marching in ragged time, metal clinking sharply against metal as weapons and armor braced for the assault. They came voicelessly, thousands and thousands of them, armored figures faceless in the deep morning gloom. Great hulking rampways made of timbers bound in iron creaked ponderously as they were pulled and pushed on metal-rimmed wheels through the half-light, mobile pathways to the heights of the fortified bluff. The seconds ticked away as the massive attack force moved within 100 yards of the waiting legion, and still the crashing drums maintained their unhurried pace. The rim of the sun became sharply visible in the east, and the waning night faded entirely in the western horizon. The drums abruptly ceased, and the sprawling army came to a sudden halt. For an instant there was a deep, unbroken silence that hung in frightened hesitation on the morning air. Then a deafening roar rose from the throats of the Northlanders. With a great surge, the massive juggernaut charged, wave upon wave, rushing to grapple with the men of the Border Legion. From beneath the closed gates of the towering outer wall, Balinor stared out at the awesome Northland assault, his broad face coolly impassive. His voice was calm and steady as he spoke briefly to his runners, sending one scurrying to find Acton and Fandwick on the left flank, the other to Messaline and Jinison on the right. His eyes returned instantly to the terrifying spectacle below the bulwarks as the wild charge drew closer. Behind the hastily constructed defenses, the legion archers and spearmen waited patiently for his command. Balinor knew they could break even this massive charge from their superior defensive position, but they must first destroy the 5 broad rampways that were rolling slowly toward the base of the bluff. He had correctly anticipated that such devices would be used to scale the plateau and its low bulwarks, just as the enemy had foreseen that he would destroy the city rampway. The vanguard of the Northland rush was within 50 feet of the bluff, and still the new king of Callahorn watched and waited. Then abruptly the ground opened beneath the feet of the charging enemy, and great holes appeared as the attackers fell screaming into the ring of camouflaged pits concealed all along the base of the plateau. 2 of the monstrous rolling rampways tumbled unchecked into the wide openings, the wheels snapping loose and the timbers shattering in splinters. The first wave of the mighty rush hesitated, and from atop the low bulwarks the legion archers rose on Balinor's long-awaited signal to fire point-blank into the ranks of the suddenly confused enemy. The dead and wounded alike fell helplessly on the plainlands and were quickly trampled under as the second wave of the sustained charge pushed through, struggling to reach the entrenched legion. 3 of the heavy rampways had avoided the concealed pits and continued to roll unhindered toward the low bulwarks. The legion archers quickly loosed a flurry of burning arrows onto the vulnerable wooden backs of the ramps, but dozens of nimble yellow bodies were immediately seen to scramble atop the flaming timbers to smother the fires. The gnome archers were also in position by this time, and for several minutes a concentrated barrage of arrows cut through the ranks of both sides. The completely exposed gnomes crawling about on the rampways were cut to pieces. Everywhere men fell screaming in pain as the deadly missiles found their human targets. The wounded men of the Border Legion were sheltered in part from further injury by the low bulwarks and could be treated for their wounds. But the fallen Northlanders lay helpless and unprotected on the open field, and hundreds were killed before they could be removed to safety. The three remaining rampways were still rolling toward the base of the fortified bluff. The one was now burning fiercely, great clouds of billowing smoke obscuring the vision of everyone passing within 100 yards. When the two remaining ramps were within 20 yards of the bulwarks, Balinor signaled for his final defense. Huge cauldrons of oil were lifted to the rim of the Southland defenses, and the contents splashed down onto the grassland below, directly in the path of the rolling rampways. Before the charging Northlanders had time to veer in either direction, torches were dropped in the midst of the spreading oil, and the entire area disappeared in a mass of flames and heavy black smoke. The sustained enemy assault broke apart as the oncoming waves of attackers hesitated in fright at the wall of flames confronting them. The foremost ranks of the enemy had been burned alive. Only a few managed to flee successfully from the terrible carnage at the base of the Legion defenses. The wind was blowing the dark smoke laterally across the open plains to the west, and for several moments the center and left flank of the two great armies were visually cut off from each other and from the wounded and dying who lay helplessly in the midst of the choking fumes. Instantly, Balinor saw his chance. A sharp counter-thrust now might break the assault completely and rout the Northland army. Leaping to his feet, he signaled to Janna Senpre atop the outer wall, who had been left in command of the city garrison. Immediately the massive iron-bound gates swung ponderously outward, and the mounted regiment of the Border Legion, armed with short swords and long hooked pikes, their leopard colors flying brightly, galloped onto the bluff, wheeling sharply left to follow the open pathway along the city wall. Within moments they had reached the left flank of the Legion defensive line where Acton and Fandwick had command of the entrenched bordermen. A portable rampway was hastily lowered from the bluff rim onto the smoke-clouded plains below, and the Legion riders, led by Acton, thundered downward and swung left in a wide circle. Balinor's instructions called for the famed regiment to cut around the wall of smoke and launch a sustained charge on the enemy's right flank. As the Northlanders turned to meet this counterattack, Balinor would bring a regiment of foot soldiers to strike at the exposed Northland front, driving the enemy back toward the Myrmidon. If the counterthrust should falter, both commands were immediately to swing back into the covering smoke and return up the waiting rampways. It was a daring gamble. The Northlanders outnumbered the Legion soldiers at least 20-1, and if the Tirzians should be cut off, they would be completely decimated. Small commands of Legion foot soldiers had already descended the mobile rampway on the left flank and staged a short counterattack into the enemy ranks as a defensive measure to protect the mounted regiment's only link with the besieged city. For the moment, the enemy seemed to have disappeared entirely on the left flank, totally obscured by the smoke which was blowing in blinding clouds from the burning rampways at the center of the defensive line. On the right defensive flank, the fighting was ferocious. Only a light, drifting haze of smoke and dust obscured the vision of the two armies at this point, and the Northland assault continued unchecked. The entrenched Legion archers had decimated the first wave of attackers, but the second wave had reached the base of the bluff and was attempting to gain the fortified heights with the aid of rough-hewn scaling ladders. Lines of gnome archers fired hundreds of arrows into the low bulwarks in an attempt to keep the defenders pinned down long enough to allow the exposed climbers to scramble over the Tirzian defenses. The Legion archers returned the fire while their comrades used iron-tipped pikes from the rim of the defenses to push away the enemy assault. It was a long, bloody fight during which neither side rested. At one point, a particularly fierce band of rangy rock trolls breached the Legion defenses and rushed onto the open bluff. A fierce battle raged for a short time as the bulky Legion commander Jinison, his florid face as red as his long hair, rallied his soldiers to resist the great trolls. In bloody hand-to-hand combat, the legionnaires killed the small band of attackers and closed the breach. At the summit of the high outer wall, four old friends stood in silence with Janus Senpre and watched the terrible spectacle unfolding below them. Hendel, Minyan Lee, Jiren, and Dale had all been left inside the city, their assignment to observe the progress of the battle and to aid Balinor in coordinating the movements of the Legion. The rolling smoke clouds totally obscured the giant borderman's vision of the movements of his mounted regiment, and only those atop the towering city walls could advise him of its progress so that he could launch his own assault from the center of the defensive line at the proper moment. The king relied particularly on Hendel's judgment, for the taciturn dwarf had been fighting nearly 30 years in the Anar border wars. Now the grizzled hunter, the Southlander, and the elven brothers stared anxiously at the panorama spread out on the plains beneath them. On the right defensive flank, the fighting was the heaviest, as the determined Northlanders continued to batter the entrenched legion, struggling to scale the face of the bluff. The Border Legion was holding on, but it was taking everything it had to beat back the ferocious assault. The plains immediately below the city gates at the center of the bulwarks were obscured by the burning oil and wooden rampways, which had crumbled entirely into masses of flaming timbers. At the fringes of the smoke, the disorganized Northlanders were vainly attempting to draw up their confused battle lines to renew the shattered charge. On the left, the Legion horsemen had broken out of the cover of the rolling black smoke and were encountering their first signs of resistance. A large squad of gnome cavalry had been stationed on the right attack flank as a defensive measure against exactly the kind of maneuver that was underway. However, the Northlanders had anticipated some advance warning of any flanking assault and were caught completely by surprise. The poorly trained gnome riders were quickly scattered by the Border Legion, and the attack on the Northland army's exposed flank began in earnest. Fanning wide to the north, the fabled regiment lowered its hooked pikes and formed a wall 3 columns deep, charging into the center of the astonished enemy. Acton led his soldiers in a precision rush that cut deeply into the exposed flank and nearly routed the extreme right of the Northland army. As the little group atop the outer wall watched expectantly, the enemy instantly readjusted its lines to the right of center to meet this new attack. As they did so, Hendel immediately signaled down to Balinor. A second rampway was lowered from the center of the defensive lines, and the tall figure of Messaline was seen to appear at the head of a second regiment of Legion soldiers, who descended on foot onto the smoke-clouded grasslands. A rear guard remained posted at the foot of the mobile ramp as the second regiment disappeared into the dark haze. Balinor closed his defensive lines and hurriedly joined his friends atop the Great Wall to observe the outcome of his counter-thrust. It had been perfectly executed. Just as the surprised right flank of the massive Northland army wheeled to face the oncoming charge of the Border Legion's mounted regiment, the foot soldiers commanded by Messaline attacked from out of the smoke at the center of the defensive line. In a tightly drawn phalanx, with spears bristling through a wall of locked shields, the highly trained legion advanced into the midst of the unprepared and confused enemy. Like cattle, the Northlanders were herded backward, scores dropping, dying and wounded every few paces. The horsemen of Acton continued to press in from the left. The entire right wing of the enemy line began to collapse, and the cries of terror grew so shrill that even the fierce assault on the right defensive flank wavered momentarily as the bewildered Northlanders stared westward in a vain effort to discover what had happened. From the summit of the outer wall, Minyan Lee stared in amazement.
It's unbelievable. The Legion is actually driving them back. They're beaten.
Not yet, breathed Hendel softly. The real test comes in a moment. The Highlander's eyes returned to the battle.
The Northlanders were still falling back before the onslaught of the attacking legion, but there was fresh activity taking place behind the lines of the retreating enemy. The army of the Warlock Lord would not be defeated so easily. What it lacked in training, it made up for in size. Already a vast command of mounted gnome horsemen was racing around the rear of the driven foot soldiers, called up to meet the attack of the legion riders. The gnomes drew up immediately north of Acton's advancing horsemen. Supported by several lines of archers and slingers, they rushed to the attack. From the rear center of the enemy army, a vast body of tall figures sheathed entirely in armor had drawn into a tight, box-like formation and had begun to advance through its own wilting army toward the legion foot soldiers. For a moment, the men atop the outer wall stared speculatively, then started in astonishment as the armored warriors suddenly began to cut their way with pikes and swords through the retreating men of their own army. It was the most savage act Menyn had ever witnessed. "Rock trolls," Balinor exclaimed heatedly. "They'll slaughter Messaline and his whole command. Signal retreat, Janus." Obediently, his newest commander hoisted a large red pennant on a nearby staff. Menyn Lee stared curiously at the silent borderman. It seemed that the battle had been nearly won, and still he had called for a retreat. He caught the king's eye, and the borderman smiled grimly at the unspoken question in the Highlander's eyes. "Rock trolls are trained to fight from birth. It's their way of life. In hand-to-hand combat, they are better fighters than the men of the Border Legion. They are better trained and much stronger physically. We have nothing to gain in pressing the attack. We've already hurt them badly, and we still hold the bluff. If we plan to defeat them, we must chip away at the strength of peace at a time." Menyn nodded in understanding. With a brief wave, Balinor left the battlements to return to his command below. His primary concern at the moment was protecting the path of retreat for his two regiments, and that meant a successful defense of the portable ramps, the soldiers' only link with the city. The Highlander watched the broad figure disappear from view, then turned back to the wall. The carnage on the plains below was frightful. The bodies of slain and wounded men lay scattered all the way from the bluff face to the rear lines of the Northland army. It was the worst slaughter that any of the little group had ever witnessed, and they watched speechlessly as the terrible struggle continued. In the distance, the legion foot soldiers under Messaline's command had begun an orderly retreat back toward the city defenses, but the giant rock trolls had almost succeeded in forcing their way through the milling front ranks of their own army and were preparing to pursue the hated Tersians. While the foot soldiers were withdrawing without opposition, the mounted regiment had encountered unexpected resistance from the charging gnome horsemen. The two forces were engaged in a fierce battle to the left of the advancing trolls. Acton was apparently either unable or unwilling to break away from the persistent attackers, and his riders were being subjected to a withering crossfire from the double line of gnome archers positioned directly to his north. A large mixed body of gnome and troll swordsmen had worked their way around behind the charging horsemen, and now Acton's command was boxed in on three sides. Hendel began to mutter angrily to himself. For the first time, Menyn became concerned. Even Janus Senpre was pacing the walkway nervously. Their worst fears were realized a moment later. The pursuing body of trolls, fresh for the wearing chase, had rushed forward so rapidly that the retreating men of Tirsis, tired and worn from their counterattack, had been unable to gain the safety of the bluff. Almost 100 yards from the waiting rampway, they turned to fight. The billowing smoke from the scattered fires rolled like a black wall in front of the low bulwarks, completely obscuring Balinor's vision as he waited before the city gates. But the unexpected turn of events was clearly visible to the horrified men watching from atop the towering city wall. "I've got to warn Balinor," Hendel exclaimed abruptly, leaping down from his position on the parapets. "That whole command will be cut to pieces." John Asenpre left with him, but Menyon and the Elven brothers continued to stare helplessly, unable to tear themselves away as the giant rock trolls bore down on Messaline's weary men. The Legion soldiers had drawn together with shields locked and spears extended, the shafts braced against the hard earth for the rush. The trolls, too, had gone into a phalanx formation, somewhat wider than it was long, their intention clearly to close in on the Southlanders from three sides and break their defense by sheer strength. Menyon glanced hastily over the wall, but Balinor had not moved, still unaware that an entire regiment of the famed Border Legion was on the verge of annihilation. Even as the Highlander shifted his glance back to the plainlands, he saw Hendel and Janus reach the tall borderman's side, gesturing wildly. It would not be in time, Menyon shouted inwardly. They were going to be too late. But suddenly, a strange thing happened. Acton's entire mounted command, momentarily forgotten by the viewers on the city wall, unexpectedly broke away from the attacking gnome horsemen with an abrupt surge and came together in perfect formation, swinging in a sharp arc directly east behind the pursuing rock trolls. At a full gallop, the superb horsemen cut through the gnome riders who barred their way. Oblivious to the hail of arrows showered down from the enraged gnome archers, they raced directly toward the troll ranks. Pikes lowered, the regiment struck the rear lines of the troll phalanx in a raking movement, continuing its sweep eastward across the plains. The giant warriors were caught by surprise, and dozens crumpled to the ground as the pikes cut into them. But these were the finest fighting men in the world, and they recovered instantly, closing their ranks and turning to meet this new threat. As Acton's horsemen swung westward once more, racing back at breakneck speed, raking across the rear of the troll phalanx a second time, the Northlanders struck back viciously with hurled pikes and maces. Over a dozen riders fell lifelessly from their mounts, and an equal number slumped wounded in their saddles as the regiment charged eastward and then cut sharply south for the safety of Tircis. Acton had accomplished his purpose. The timely diversion had permitted Messaline's besieged regiment to make a sudden break for the concealing smoke. It was a brilliantly executed maneuver, and atop the outer wall, those watching shouted with unrestrained admiration. Though pursued by the foremost ranks of the infuriated trolls, the Legion foot soldiers had escaped into the concealing smoke, and most, with the aid of Balinor at the head of a relief squad, gained the safety of the waiting ramp. A sharp battle was fought at the foot of the bluff as the regiment struggled to withdraw the lowered bridge before the enemy could seize it. Finally, it was simply cast loose from the bulwarks and dropped onto the plain below, where it lay intact only